Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Love, Janessa, a brand new true crime podcast from the BBC World Service and CBC Podcasts, exploring the world of online romance scams. It's a story about love, deceit, and survival, and it's available now. Find out more at the end of this podcast.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Kesha Madeira, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 26th of January, these are our main stories. The United States has joined Germany in announcing it will send powerful tanks to Ukraine to help it defend itself against Russia. Kyiv welcomed the news, but Russia's reacted angrily to the decisions, calling them a dangerous escalation. Police in Brazil have opened an investigation into whether the treatment of an indigenous tribe in the Amazon amounts to genocide. Also in this podcast... Lloyd Morissette, one of the creators of the groundbreaking US children's television programme, has died at the age of 93. President Biden has announced the United States will send tanks to Ukraine in a significant policy reversal. Speaking at the White House in Washington, Mr. Biden insisted the M1 Abrams vehicles would not be an offensive threat to Russia, but would help protect Ukrainian land.
Today, I'm announcing that the United States will be sending 31 Abrams tanks to Ukraine. The Abrams tanks are the most capable tanks in the world. They're also extremely complex to operate and maintain. So we're also giving Ukraine the parts and equipment necessary to effectively sustain these tanks on the battlefield. And we'll begin to train the Ukrainian troops on these issues of sustainment, logistics and maintenance as soon as possible.
The U.S. announcement comes hours after Germany confirmed that it would supply 14 of its Leopard tanks. Britain has pledged 14 tanks of its own. For more on the U.S. development, I asked our correspondent in Washington, Gary O'Donoghue, why this decision had been taken now.
Well, this has been something that's been on the stove for a while, bubbling away, and the Americans were quite reluctant, I think, to up the ante in terms of shipping tanks into Ukraine. Number one, because it's pretty expensive and these are complex pieces of equipment. They were worried about the support mechanisms for Ukraine. But also, I think they were worried about, you know, the level of escalation that this represented. I think what's brought them to the table now is the desire to preserve unity. And, of course, there were fractures showing in Europe, particularly between Poland and Germany, over whether or not to send Leopard 2 tanks. And this does seem to have smoothed the way for that to take place with this American promise. So I think that's why now.
So these are complicated bits of kit. Just talk us through, how soon can these tanks realistically be delivered?
It's months rather than weeks. The funding source for these is one of the two sources the Americans have been using, and it's the source that doesn't involve taking it from current stock. So these things have to be purchased, ordered and purchased. That means it takes longer. The Ukrainians will have to be trained. That training will take place outside Ukraine. We don't know where it will be, but it won't be inside Ukraine. That all means that these Abrams tanks, I don't think, will be there for this possible spring offensive that people have talked about in terms of the Russian forces, although that it may be possible, having unlocked the process in Europe, that some of those tanks nearer in Poland and Germany may be able to be there for that.
And in terms of on the battlefield itself, what kind of a difference could they make?
Huge firepower, huge amounts of manoeuvrability. It's one of the best tanks in the world, the Abrams. They are massive, 60-odd tonnes. They can go 45 miles an hour on the road. I mean, they're fast. And they will give the Ukrainians a manoeuvrability that they don't have up till now, not just necessarily for defensive reasons, but retaking territory as well. I think this will be a significant contribution to their arsenal.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. Now let's turn to Germany's decision to send Leopard 2 battle tanks to Ukraine. The defense minister said that this could happen within the next 3 months. Chancellor Olaf Scholz told Parliament in Berlin that the decision was concerning for many Germans, but he said that every effort was being made to help Ukraine in the safest way possible without bringing Germany into another conflict. Our correspondent Jessica Parker's in Berlin.
Olaf Scholz has been in the eye of a diplomatic storm. The international pressure to sanction the delivery of these tanks to Ukraine has been intense, and divisions within his own coalition government have been obvious. But speaking in the Bundestag in a typically understated fashion, the Chancellor insisted it had been right not to rush the decision.
Es gibt in diesem Land viele Bürgerinnen und Bürger.
He urged any concerned citizens to trust the government and said that by working with allies, it was possible to take this step without increasing the risks to Germany. His defense minister, Boris Pistorius, offered his own sober assessment.
Das ist kein Grund zum Jubeln.
It's no reason to celebrate, even if some people want to. Everyone has to decide for themselves. Personally, I have great understanding for the people in Germany and Europe who are worried. All surveys show that half of people are concerned about the development and Germany's involvement through weapons deliveries and other things.
Polls suggest public opinion is split on whether it's right to send Leopard 2s to Ukraine. As an aggressor in two world wars, the idea of German-made tanks rolling east may trigger discomfort. And some people I spoke to in Berlin today backed Olaf Scholz in taking time to weigh things up.
It was the right way to think about it very carefully because it's a very dangerous decision on the one hand. On the other hand, I think it's high time to support Ukraine.
You cannot win a war by tanks.
So you think that this is the wrong decision?
Sending tanks means increasing the military option.
Many of my colleagues are also said, what's not our war? Why we have so to support them? But I think we have to support Ukraine. Ukraine is a neighbor.
For Chancellor Olaf Scholz, it seems that pulling the US into pledging its own tanks has been crucial. Despite being one of the biggest suppliers of military aid to Ukraine, Germany once again stands accused of having to be bullied into action at a cost to the country's reputation.
Jessica Parker in Berlin. Well, in Ukraine itself, our correspondent Andrew Harding has spent the past few days reporting alongside forces trying to retake areas seized by the Russians. He's been considering if Western tanks will make a difference to the fighting.
Ukrainian tanks, half a century old, fire on Russian positions around the Donbas town of Bakhmut. Ukrainian forces are slowly losing ground here. And when we visited this tank unit last week, the mood seemed close to despair.
Both sides have heavy losses, but we need more equipment, we need more weapons. We appreciate the support of our partners.
No surprise, then, to find many Ukrainians celebrating the news that more modern Western tanks will soon be on their way here. President Zelensky expressed his gratitude in a tweet, calling it timely and important. At a bus station in the frontline city of Zaporizhia, most commuters agreed. Russia has better weapons than we do, so this is good news, said Vasily. We need any weapons from any countries to help us kick the Russians out of here and protect our borders, said a pensioner named Alina Orlova. Ukrainian tanks charge along a wooded track in the Donbas. For now, Ukrainian troops continue to fight with what they have. It may still be a while before modern Western machines are roaring alongside them.
Andrew Harding reporting. Well, Russia's responded angrily to Germany's decision to send the Leopard 2 battle tanks. This was the Kremlin spokesperson, Dmitry Peskov.
I'm certain that many experts understand the absurdity of this idea. Simply for technological reasons, this plan is a loser. Importantly, it's a clear overestimation of the potential it will add to the Ukrainian armed forces. This is a misconception, and it is quite profound. We repeat that these tanks will burn, just like all the others.
I spoke to our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, and I asked him whether Moscow's concerned by these latest developments from Germany and the US.
I think Russia probably is worried. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, really interesting, mixed messages coming out from Russia today, because on the one hand, you had Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin spokesman, apparently downplaying or trying to downplay the significance of these Western battle tanks being delivered to Ukraine, talking about overestimation of the potential that they could add to the Ukrainian army, saying that this was a plan doomed to failure. On Russian state television, they were talking constantly about the technical problems that some of these American tanks allegedly have and how difficult they are to repair, according to Russian state television, talking about the weak points of these tanks. One allegedly military expert on state television described the Abrams tank as a hippopotamus. But on the other hand, you had other Russian officials, like the Russian ambassador to Berlin, talking about this as an extremely dangerous development, that Western battle tanks are being sent to Ukraine, talking about a new level of confrontation that it brings. And on the subject of this confrontation, this new level, that the rhetoric, the anti-European, anti-Western rhetoric in the state media has reached a new level. It is completely off the scale now. And you have some astonishing comments. And I saw one of state television's most prominent news anchors making quite remarkable comments about Germany, basically accusing German political leaders of being Nazis and saying that when German tanks appear in Ukraine, that will make German territory and German bases a target for Russia.
And Steve, on that point, there's always been a concern about escalation. Just talk us through what countermeasures could the Kremlin take?
Well, we'll have to wait and see. Some military commentators here are urging the Kremlin to take military action because they say that Russia's red lines are continually crossed by the West, by NATO, by the United States. I think we'll have to wait and see.
Steve Rosenberg in Russia. Now let's turn to other news. It's almost 2 years since the military coup in Myanmar stopped the country's transition to democracy. New research, shared exclusively with the BBC, has found that Burmese women who oppose the military government are being systematically abused and doxxed online. Now, doxing is when private information is posted on social media, and in these cases, it's alongside calls for violence. This report by Reha Kansara begins with the voice of a woman in hiding. And just to warn you, you may find this report upsetting.
Day by day, the army-owned media and military lobbyists direct message me. Do you want to sleep with me? I will destroy you. I will kill you.
Ethan Zamang is on the military's most wanted list. She's talking to me over Zoom from a secret location in the Burmese jungle. As a minister for the opposition party, she's also one of the more prominent Burmese women being targeted with hate speech and abuse on social media by pro-military actors. According to Myanmar Witness, an NGO documenting human rights abuses in the country, female politicians, activists, journalists, celebrities, even ordinary women who oppose the junta are systematically abused on Facebook and Telegram. Mimi Kant, an analyst who worked on a new report for Myanmar Witness, explains.
There are online channels and accounts that are spreading horrifying, derogatory and often sexualized narrative about women. Almost 90% of these abuse posts are coming from the pro-military side.
These posts, which the BBC has seen, include misogynistic sexualized abuse, Photoshop pornography, as well as racist abuse that weaponizes any perceived support for the Muslim Rohingya minority who have previously been targeted by hate speech online. But it goes further than that. Here's Mimi Kant again.
One of the main tactics that they use is doxing.
If someone is doxed, their private information has been posted online to identify them or their location without their consent. Thinzar Shunleyi, a pro-democracy Burmese activist, has faced a barrage of doxing campaigns. She now lives in exile in fear for her safety and her family's too.
First, it was just my account, like they were sharing, we know what you're doing, and they share my screenshot. And the next time, they include my family information, like where I lived, what's my ID number, what's my phone number, and some personal information, including my sister's face and photos and, you know.
According to Myanmar Witness's research, a quarter of the cases of doxing they documented came with an explicit call for the military authorities to take action against these women. Many of them originated from Telegram, an encrypted messaging app. And the report claims some arrests of these women by the junta may have been a direct consequence of these coordinated campaigns. We put this claim to the military government's Deputy Minister of Information, Zor Min Tun. He said,
there is no reason we would be linked to these accounts.
When it comes to social networking sites, we monitor them as every government does. If we see something unusual, we will have to investigate.
We also flagged over 120 posts to Telegram that Myanmar Witness had identified as targeted abuse and doxing. After highlighting them, all but 18 of them were removed. And a number of the accounts appear to have been suspended. Telegram told us.
Telegram is a platform for free speech. However, sharing private information, doxing, and calling for violence are explicitly forbidden by our terms of service.
That report by Reha Kansara. Still to come.
I feel like I've just walked into a totally different part of the world. It's all green grass in here. It could be one of the cemeteries in the north of France, you know?
Our correspondent Yolande Nell visits First and Second World War graves in Gaza, looked after by generations of local families. Police in Brazil have opened an investigation into whether the treatment of members of an indigenous tribe in the Amazon amounts to genocide. The government declared a medical emergency in the Yanomami Reserve in northern Brazil following reports that young children had been dying of severe malnutrition and diseases linked to illegal mining. Warren Bull reports.
The police investigation will focus on illegal mining operations in the state of Roraima, where miners have carried out deadly attacks on tribal members and polluted river systems with mercury. Prompted by the new justice minister, federal police will determine if these acts were part of a deliberate targeting of the Yanomami and whether the federal government under Jair Bolsonaro had failed in its responsibilities to protect them. During his 4 years in office, the right-wing former military officer defended the development of mining, logging and agricultural activities inside natural reserves and indigenous lands.
Warren Bull reporting. In Afghanistan, the United Nations humanitarian chief has expressed hope that the Taliban might further relax their ban on women working for aid organisations in the country. Martin Griffiths told the BBC that he'd received encouraging responses from a wide range of Taliban ministers, suggesting new guidelines would be drawn up even if the ban itself would not be reversed. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, reports from Kabul.
Martin Griffiths stressed that the aid operation in Afghanistan was not just the biggest in the world, it was the biggest ever. 28 million people, more than half the population, were in need, including 6 million who were, in his words, knocking on famine's door. To reach them, he insisted that Afghan women had to be part of this humanitarian effort. The UN chief says that since the edict was issued last month, the Taliban had given exemptions for women to work in vital areas like health and education. But I pointed out that a Taliban minister told us the UN was disrespecting Afghans' religious beliefs by demanding that women should work, a suggestion he rejected.
I don't agree. And I think it's unfair to characterise the United Nations as the problem here. The United Nations never left Afghanistan these many decades. And we respect the customs and norms of Afghanistan, as we do in every country that we work. All we're trying to do is to serve the people of Afghanistan and to be allowed to do so.
Mr. Griffiths said he hoped that what he'd heard in Kabul would translate into practice. But some NGOs have already suspended their operations because of this ban. His worst fear was other aid agencies would do the same, and the people of Afghanistan would pay the price of this edict.
Lise Doucette in Afghanistan. The European Court of Human Rights has confirmed it will hear a Dutch case against Russia over the downing of a Malaysia Airlines plane in 2014. Nearly 300 people on flight MH17 were killed when it was shot down over eastern Ukraine by Moscow-backed separatists. The Kremlin denies involvement. Our correspondent Anna Holligan is at The Hague.
The court has decided this case is admissible despite the fact that Russia had argued that the Netherlands had missed the time frame to apply to the European Court of Human Rights and had not fully explored the legal options inside Russia. So this is a huge blow to Russia because now this court will be exploring state responsibility. This is the first time an international court will look at state responsibility in the case of MH17.
Anna Holligan.
Next, let's turn to Lebanon. On the 4th of August 2020, large parts of the capital, Beirut, were devastated by this huge explosion. More than 200 people were killed and thousands were injured when a huge stockpile of ammonium nitrate that was being kept in a port warehouse ignited. It's believed the material had been stored improperly for several years. Well, now a row has broken out between the judge, who's been leading the investigation into the blast, Tariq Bitar, and the country's public prosecutor. I heard more about Wednesday's developments from our Middle East correspondent, Anna Foster.
This legal investigation, which is going on in Lebanon, has been absolutely dogged by problems, and it had been frozen for 13 months, more than a year, because repeated legal challenges against the judge, who was calling some very powerful people for questioning, meant that it just kept getting stopped and it wasn't moving on.
And then in terms of the investigation, we had a development on Monday.
We did, and it was surprising because the judge had been told that he was not allowed to continue while these legal challenges were being brought against him. But he came out on Monday, said that he'd done his own piece of research work and that as far as he was concerned, the law did allow him to continue. But he also named 8 new suspects, again, powerful people like the head of general security, the head of state security, and Lebanon's chief prosecutor, who, let's say, has not taken this well.
Explain to us what happened today, because there's been a pushback.
There has, from the public prosecutor, Ghassan Ouaddet, who I should say had earlier in the investigation recused himself because he is related to one of the defendants. But on Monday, when Judge Bitar said that he was going to continue the investigation and named Ghassan Ouaddet as one of the suspects that he wanted to question, this has started a whole new chain of events. And the public prosecutor today has told the lead investigating judge, Tariq Bitar, that he has to stop his work. He's also ordered the release of everybody, we believe around 20 people, but everybody who's been arrested since the investigation started. And he's also tried to charge Judge Bitar. Now, it is essentially a power struggle right at the heart of the Lebanese judiciary. But what is important to remember among all of this is the families of those victims, the people who were injured, who have waited now for 2.5 years for some kind of justice, for somebody to be held accountable for this, to go to court, to go on trial. And tonight they're out on the streets, many of them protesting again here in Beirut, because this is yet another hurdle in their fight for justice.
Anna Foster. Long before the Gaza Strip became the venue for conflicts between Palestinian militants and Israel, it was caught up in the First and Second World Wars. For generations, local families have looked after 2 cemeteries there, which belong to the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. This month, the head gardener is marking the 100th anniversary of his great-grandfather starting the same job. Our Middle East correspondent, Yolan Nell, has been to meet him.
Wow. I feel like I've just walked into a totally different part of the world. It's all green grass in here. It could be one of the cemeteries in the north of France, you know?
Yes, it's not usual in Gaza. Green, beautiful, full of flowers.
I'm shown around the neatly regimented lines of white gravestones by head gardener Ibrahim Jarada.
So there are, what, about 3,000 graves here?
Yes, around 3,500. In Gaza War Cemetery, we have from the First World War and also Second World War and also from the Canadian forces fighting with the United Nations peacekeeping operations.
And then here in Gaza, we do have regular flare-ups in violence. The conflict with Israel is ongoing. Has that affected the cemetery?
In 2021, we get some shots around and inside the cemetery. We come back everything like the past. We replacement all the headstones and the staff of Gaza replanted the grass and the flowers.
It's exactly a century since Ibrahim's great-grandfather started as a gardener in another war cemetery. He fled to Gaza in fighting after the State of Israel was created in 1948 and was asked to tend these graves.
When I was young, it's a dream for me to walk in here. I feel that I have relationship with everything here, with the stones, with the plants. We live here and working here, so I feel that the son of this cemetery.
Nowadays, tight border controls imposed by Israel and Egypt make it very difficult for foreign visitors to travel to Gaza. I needed an Israeli press card and a permit from Hamas, the militant group which governs here, to enter. But Ibrahim's father, Assam Jarada, who's now retired, remembers different times.
It was safe here. We used to have very big numbers of visitors. I used to see people's emotions, the tears in their eyes at the grandfather's graves.
Today, the cemetery is dotted with local visitors, and a veiled woman walking with her daughter hints at more troubled thoughts.
In the Quran, it says that if you're upset and have something on your chest, then you should visit the graves. I came here to relax my soul.
It takes a lot of work to keep the cemetery in a pristine state, especially when you account for the daily power cuts and severe water shortages in Gaza. But Ibrahim says it's important to preserve the memory of those who lost their lives in battles long ago, many of them young men far from home.
It's so important to respect all the dead people, whatever is their nationalities, and we hope that they will learn that the peace is the best thing in the world, and this is the effects of wars in general.
Unusually for a cemetery in the Middle East, the dead come from different faiths, with sections for Christians, Jews, Muslims and Hindus. There are allies and enemies here. In a region that still sees so much bloodshed, much of it driven by religious differences, their graves lie side by side and rest in peace.
That report by Yolande Nell in Gaza. We're ending on some rather sad news that Lloyd Morissette, the co-creator of the iconic children's television series Sesame Street, has died at the age of 93. Lloyd Morissette came up with the idea of using TV to teach children basic skills, such as learning letters and numbers. Sesame Street was first broadcast in the United States in 1969, and it's still shown around the world. Our arts correspondent Colin Patterson reports.
Few people have changed the lives of more children in the US than Lloyd Morissette. Born in Oklahoma in 1929, he worked in experimental education, exploring how to reach children from disadvantaged backgrounds. The light bulb moment came in 1965, when one morning he woke to see his three-year-old daughter staring at the test card and wondered if the addictive nature of TV could be harnessed for good. Teaming up with the producer Joan Gans Cooney, they created the Children's Television Workshop and in 1969 launched their first show, Sesame Street.
Oh, rubber ducky, you're the one.
The idea? Make it so enjoyable that kids learned without even realising. Puppets including Cookie Monster teaching them about letters.
C is for cookie, that's good enough for me.
And numbers.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
The US Department of Education once estimated that 86% of American children had seen the show before they went to school. 11, celebrity cameos became the norm, including, at the height of their fame, R.E.M.
Furry, happy, monster, slappy.
Sesame Street is still shown in more than 150 countries, and Lloyd Morissette was involved right to the end of his life, serving on the Sesame Workshop board at the age of 93.
The soundtrack of my childhood. Our arts correspondent there, Colin Patterson, remembering the life of Lloyd Morissette, the co-creator of Sesame Street. Well, that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast a little later. If you'd like to comment on this podcast or any of the topics covered in it, please do so. Send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Alicia Thursting. The producer is Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Kasia Madeira. Until next time, bye-bye.
From the BBC World Service and CBC Podcasts.
The longest part of a scam is really the grooming process.
I keep thinking so much about you. I miss you so badly.
She was trying to get me to send her money.
Initially it was for a broken phone, fixing something in a car.
Love, Janessa, the true crime podcast exploring how one woman's stolen images are being used by criminals as bait to target people looking for love online.
She has to be one of the most catfished images.
Really, anyone can fall for this, right? There's no one type of victim.
I think he sent her close to $5,000.
Oh my gosh!
She said, if you really loved me, you'd do what I asked you to do.
And then you responded.
You used a fake identity, a false story, and stolen photographs. Why should I give you anything at all?
Join Hannah Ajala as she goes in search of the woman whose face has unwittingly launched countless romance scams. It's a story about love, deceit, and survival, and it's available now. Search for Love Janessa wherever you found this podcast.
Today, running your small or mid-sized business is challenging to say the least. There is greater pressure to offer a flexible and safe work environment. At HP, we get that. We design our products to support the needs of both the traditional office space and your employees' hybrid environment. We create IT solutions that help run your small or mid-sized business no matter where your employees are. Whether you have 5 employees or 500, HP can help. Call our U.S.-based small business advisor team today at 1-800-608-MYHP or click below.